Today's reading comes from Genesis 12 to 13, found on page 8 of your pew Bibles. Genesis 12. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran. And they set out to go to the land of Canaan. When they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built there an altar to the Lord, who had appeared to him. From there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed on, still going towards the Negev. Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. When he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, "I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake." When Abram entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. And when the princes of Pharaoh saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into the Pharaoh's house. And for her sake, he dealt well with Abram. And he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants, female servants, female donkeys, and camels. But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. So Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." And Pharaoh gave men orders concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him into the Negev. Now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold. And he journeyed on from the Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place where he had made an altar at the first. And there Abram called upon the name of the Lord. And Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. At that time, the Canaanites and the Perizzites were dwelling in the land. Then Abram said to Lot, "Let there be no strife between you and me, and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if you take the right hand, then I will go to the left." And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well-watered everywhere like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, in the direction of Zoar. This was before the Lord had destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley, and moved his tent as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, "Lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northwards and southwards, and eastwards and westwards. For all the land that you see, I will give to you and to your offspring forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted. Arise, walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I will give it to you. So Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron. And there he built an altar to the Lord. Genesis 12 and 13.
Thank you, Cindy, for that reading. Do keep that passage open if you want to follow along with the talk. And also you'll be able to find a handout, an outline of where the talk's going in the middle of your service sheets as well. Alicia, could we get the first picture up? Amy and I and our two young boys are going for our first camping trip as a family in August. We've completely wimped out. We're going to be glamping rather than camping. We're going to somewhere called Pete's Field, a pop-up camping experience. Sounds very millennial, doesn't it? And it is very millennial. Somebody else is pitching our tent. Somebody else will be lighting our fire. We are complete millennial snowflakes. Now, maybe you love hardcore camping. And maybe I do look like a snowflake to you. But even if that's you, everybody has their limits, don't they, when it comes to camping? I mean, it's one thing to camp out in the wilderness for a few weeks. But I bet none of us want to live our whole lives under canvas. Imagine being a nomad, like Abram, in this passage, and living your whole life in a tent. You know, there is a reason why most people settle in towns and cities. Not everybody, of course. Some people do want to live that way. But most of us just don't want the hard work of never truly settling, never putting down roots. But that was the life of Abram in our passage today. I wonder if you noticed that. I counted at least five stops as Abram journeyed in faith from one place to the next. Could we get the map up, Alicia? And he's traveling massive distances. This place here, that's Israel. You can see there's Egypt, so the north coast of Africa. And that's only half of his travels in this passage. It doesn't show the travels after he'd come back from Egypt as well. Now, clearly, when it comes to the life of faith for Christians, we aren't called to literally live under canvas like Abram. And that is good news. But this kind of life, this life of a nomad, is a really good picture of what it means to be a Christian in this world. Because you see, the more you trust God's promises, the more you're going to find that you simply don't fit in this world anymore, that you can't really call it home, that you can't settle down in it. And camping can feel like an adventure at first, but after a few weeks, the adventure wears off as reality bites, and maybe you felt that as a Christian. A big adventure when you started out. Following God, it's going to be so exciting. He's made such amazing promises to me. I'm going to follow him anywhere. But then as the years pass by and you discover that following his promises makes you, well, weird to the people around you, never quite able to, well, live comfortably alongside them, well, it gets tiring, doesn't it? Maybe you felt the weariness of that. Maybe you felt the pressure to stop following God and living for a future world that you can't even see. And instead to just, well, quietly settle back down in this world. Abram is famously called the father of faith. And the family of faith, as you go on through the Bible, it's not so much Abram's physical descendants, though it includes lots of them. But all believers in every age are Abram's sons and daughters. If only we share his faith in God. But the thing is, we're also going to see that Abraham's faith in God was wobbly, just like ours. He experienced times when he got tired of camping out in Canaan. We see one of those today when he heads off to Egypt for a bit more security. And the thing is that over the course of the summer, we're going to see that sometimes wobbly faith has disastrous consequences for Abraham and his family. But over the course of the summer, we're also going to see Abraham's faith growing firmer and firmer and firmer as he goes on in his life. And the firmer it grows, the more God uses him to do good to the people around him and to the coming generations. So if you feel like your faith in God can sometimes be wobbly, if you feel like you need encouragement to keep pursuing firmer faith in God, then I hope these chapters will help you immensely. And I think we see some of the encouragement right from the get-go today. Today's passage is so realistic, isn't it, about how hard it is to have faith, but it encourages us to keep going. I think the big thrust of today's passage is just this: keep trusting God's promises, even though it stops you settling in this world. Keep going. We'll begin on a positive note, though, not looking at the difficulties of having faith, but some of the great things about it as we look at God's promises. Did you see what God promises? This is our first point, then. God's blessings to and through Abraham promise everybody a new, happy world. You can't miss the big thing that God promises Abraham here, can you? Look at chapter 12, verse 2. 12, verse 2, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you, make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Bless, blessing, bless, bless, blessed. And bless here is not about how we react to a cute puppy. Oh, bless. No, it's a word with massive weight in Genesis. You see, to bless somebody in Genesis is to wish them happiness in all departments of life. It's to wish on them the good life, health, wealth, peace. And when God blesses somebody, it is a guarantee that that person is going to live the good life. The blessed life is actually the kind of life we saw in Eden at the start of Genesis, where God plants a garden to be a paradise home for mankind. But that paradise was lost when in Genesis 3, mankind rebelled against God's good rule, rejecting our Maker, the source of all blessing in this life. And in response, God cursed mankind, above all with death. And then from Genesis 4 to 11, we watch as again and again people are born only to have their lives ruined by their own rejection of God, their sin, and by God's curse, particularly his curse of death. But now here, in these promises to Abraham, it is like God is saying, I will hit the reset button on this world to remake it into a place where there is no more curse, no more sin. A world where everybody from all the families of the earth lives under my good rule and is blessed. Lives the good life once more. You see, understood in context, God seems to be promising actually a whole new world here. And it's a promise for the whole world. Yes, to Abraham in the first place, but ultimately through him to all the families of the earth. It's not automatic. Whoever dishonors Abraham will be cursed still. But whoever blesses him, whoever lines up their life behind Abraham and his faith, trusts in the promises that God has made to him, recognizes that God is doing something incredibly special through this man, well, they get to join in this hope of a whole new world, a new paradise home. These promises are hope-inspiring, history-defining, world-transforming promises. And I know it is hard to see it that way at times because, well, they're not actually fulfilled yet, are they? Where is the paradise world that God is promising here? We're still waiting for it. And actually, even Abraham received very little of it in this life. The fulfillment of these promises begins really slowly with Abraham's physical descendants just getting this little patch of earth, Canaan, which we now know as Israel. But eventually, the blessings balloon to encompass this promise of a whole new creation, where sin and death are no more. And if only we will trust like Abraham did, we will have a part in it when it comes. I hope these promises thrill your heart if you're a believer today. But if you're not a believer, then you might be asking, why did God choose Abraham to get these promises? What's so special about him? Can we have our next picture up, Alicia? Do you recognize these guys? These guys are slugging it out at the moment to prove that they are the special one. Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt contesting the leadership of the Tory party and actually the whole nation. Bojo, Boris, is trying to maintain that he is the Churchillian special one. He can lead the Tories and the nation to greatness again. Jeremy Hunt is trying to persuade everyone that he is the trustworthy candidate to steward the party and the nation's future. A tough choice, maybe? Well, as for God choosing Abraham, that's not a tough choice. That's a terrible choice. I don't know what you think of these two, but as for Abraham, he has nothing to commend him to God. You see, Abraham, he's just a man like everybody else, a sinner living under God's curse. We didn't read the end of chapter 11, but if we had, we would have learned that his brother died young. His father had only just died when God made these promises. His wife, Sarai, couldn't have children, as though the curse of death had, in a way, entered her womb. Now, Abraham, he's a cursed man like everybody else, so why him? And even in today's passage, we see he's not a particularly good steward of the faith, is he? As he has his first wobble in the faith. Panics that God might not be protecting him, and in the face of a famine in chapter 12, verse 10, heads off to Egypt to find security under the protection of Pharaoh. And ends up lying in the process to protect his own skin at the expense of his wife's purity and reputation, almost. Why Abraham, God? Well, to teach us that God does good to bad people. You see, in the New Testament, when the Apostle Paul celebrates Abraham's faith in the book of Romans in chapter 4, he, in the same breath, calls Abraham ungodly, unrighteous. God chose to bless ungodly Abraham to teach us that he is going to bless mankind, not because we've somehow earned an end to the curse, but simply because God chooses to bless us out of sheer, gratuitous, unmerited kindness to people. He just wants to do good to bad people. He chooses Abraham not because he deserves it, but because he doesn't. He chooses ungodly Abraham to teach us that he's willing to bless anybody who will trust him. And I hope that's a massive encouragement to you this morning. Maybe you're somebody who knows they've messed up their life big time. Maybe you know that's because you've done life your way rather than God's way. Maybe like Abraham, you even started out well in the life of faith and then just wandered away from it. And if it hasn't got you in trouble yet, it will do one day. Maybe you feel very acutely that the last thing you deserve now is a home in this paradise world that God promises, the good life. Because you know that you've not led a good life. Well, if that's you, can I say that you're half right? You don't deserve it. None of us do. I certainly don't. But you're also half wrong. Because being a sinner under God's curse of death is no barrier to joining the family and receiving God's blessing. Having wobbles in your faith is no barrier to reaffirming your faith. The father of faith was as messy as the rest of us. There is nothing, therefore, to stop you joining his family by following in his footsteps of faith. These promises, they really are for everyone who will trust God like Abraham did. In one sense, it's as simple as that. That's all you've got to do. You've just got to trust God. Take him at his word. But there is always small print, isn't there? Here's the small print. All you've got to do is trust. These promises really are for everyone who will trust. But, point two, trust keeps Abraham and us from ever truly settling in this world. Now, I've called this the small print, but actually, it's not small print, is it? It's right up front. It's the very first verse of chapter 12. You see, the promises, they come with a command. Verse 1 of chapter 12, go. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and so on. You see, God is upfront about the cost of trusting in his promises. He's not hiding it or burying it in the small print. No, following him, trusting in him, will involve sacrifice for Abraham. And because Abraham trusts, he obeys, and he makes the sacrifice. Literally sacrificing, as it were, his place in the family home. He takes a lot of family with him. I don't know whether you noticed that. There's no pun intended there, but quite literally he takes a lot from his family with him. His nephew, Lot. It's a terrible pun, I'm sorry. If Darren were here, he'd be laughing, but it doesn't look like he is. Never mind. And in verse 5, we see he takes a lot of servants as well. So when you think of Abraham camping in Canaan, you've got to think of a big caravan, a kind of sheikdom, if you like, not just one man in his tent. But you know, having all these people with him, it doesn't make it easier, it makes it harder. Can you imagine what it's like having to organize a family on that scale, a household on that scale, as you travel through the ancient world into the unknown? But off Abraham goes, leaving behind the city of Haran that we see at the end of chapter 11. And from then on, Abraham would never live in a city again, but would spend the rest of his life as a nomad, camping in Canaan, apart from this brief wobble into Egypt. For Abraham, living under canvas must have really rubbed in for him that this world was not his permanent home, that he was just passing through. And you know, even when he gets to Canaan, it turns out that the land already has owners. Did you see that in verse 6? 12 verse 6, at that time the Canaanites were in the land. And it's repeated again, 13 verse 7. Amy and I once went skiing in the French Alps, and to keep costs down, we arranged our accommodation through a French website where French people rent accommodation from other French people. Apparently they give each other preferential rates. Who'd have thought it? Only we arrived, after driving there in our banged up Toyota Corolla, at about 9:30 in the evening. And when we got there, we knocked on the door to discover that the room was already occupied by a Danish girl who thought that she was renting the room for the entire ski season. So there we were in the middle of the night, faced with having to camp out in the middle of the freezing Alps in our rusty Toyota Corolla. Fortunately, it was just a mix-up because of our bad French. But there is no mix-up for Abraham. He arrives at the land. It's occupied. It can't ever be his home. In fact, it transpires, God makes clear to him after he's got there, that it's only his descendants who are actually going to take ownership. Did you see that? in, is it 12 verse 7? It's your offspring that I'll give this land to, Abraham. And we're going to learn next week that that won't come until several centuries have passed. Now, for Abraham, trusting God's promises meant giving up a home and not getting one in this life, but being a nomad his whole life in a foreign land. I guess verse 9 kind of sums it up, this picture of Abraham. Verse 8 and 9, pitching his tent in verse 8, then packing up his tent again in verse 9 and journeying on. And he does it again at the end of the passage, comes back from Egypt, pitches his tent, packs it up, pitches his tent, packs it up. But did you notice, though, that that's not even the biggest thing that stops Abraham from feeling at home in Canaan? Did you see what Abraham built when he arrived in Canaan? Verse 7, 12 verse 7, end of the verse. He built there an altar to the Lord. Again, verse 8, there he built an altar and called on the Lord's name. And again in 13 verse 18, he builds another altar. Now, the very last thing that we'd have seen built in Genesis, if we read the whole thing, would have been not an altar, but a city. A towering city. Can we get the picture up, Alicia? This is Bruegel's picture of it. The city of Babel, the tower city of Babel. Built, interestingly, as a home for the people of the earth. Built, really interestingly, as a home for them to make a great name for themselves. Why is it that Abraham was building altars to the Lord? Well, because 12 verse 2, he doesn't need to build cities to make a great name for himself because God has promised to give him a great name. So he doesn't need to build cities. He doesn't need to build a home for himself. He doesn't need to big up his own name because he trusts that God will provide him with all those things. And so what he builds are altars to make the name of the Lord great in worship of him. That's really what makes Abraham different to the people around him. He's not living to build himself a home. He's not living to, build up his own reputation. He trusts God will do that. And he lives to build up God's reputation, to worship him, to make his name great, as he lives a life of trust and dependence, calling on the name of the Lord. Well, it's a model start, isn't it, from Abraham and Lot too, don't you think? Hallowed be your name. That's what he's saying. That's what we say when we pray the Lord's Prayer. And the more we mean it, the more it will stop us from fitting in and settling in the world that rejects God. Imagine you're at your next interview. I don't know where you're at your stage of life, but if you've got any interviews coming up soon, and you get asked what your ambitions are for the next 5 years of your career, and you say, I don't really... care what I achieve for myself. I just want to make God's name look great. I want to depend on him in this life. And I want other people to depend on him too and learn to trust in his great promises. You would tank at interview if that was your response, wouldn't you? So please, don't say that at interview if you want to get the job. But that is what your life should be saying, taken in the round, if you're a believer. And it should stop you from ever settling down in this world, ever fitting in with the people around you, because living that way is just so, it's different, isn't it, to the world around us? Living not for our greatness, but for God's. Trusting that he will make us great in his own time. Well, like I say, it's a model start to the life of faith from Abraham and Lot. But the rest of the passage is not so smooth sailing. Abram and Lot, they experience all sorts of ups and downs in their faith. We're not going to look at them in much detail. We're drawing to a close now. We'll just finish with a couple of quick applications from 12:10 to the end of the passage. Now, whenever Abram and Lot's faith wobbles, you see them leave behind the nomadic life. It's really interesting. Did you notice that? So first, Abram, when his faith wobbles in the face of a famine, and he starts to doubt whether God really has his back and will protect him, he heads to Egypt. Now, God gets Abram back to Canaan, and Abram seems to have learned his lesson. He never leaves the land of Canaan again. But then in chapter 13, Lot copies Abram's earlier mistake, and he abandons the land. Did you see that? 13 verse 12 sums it up. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. Abram in the land, but Lot now, well, just sort of on the edge of the land, trying to have a foot in both camps, as it were, still in his tent, but he's parked his tent right next to a big city, the city of Sodom. Of course, you can understand why he'd want to do that, can't you? I mean, if you can't, look at verse 10 with me. It's really striking. Lot chooses Sodom, actually, because it's like Egypt. He has the same sort of motivation as Abraham. Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, where his uncle just took him. You see, what Lot wants is a life of, well, a settled life of peace and prosperity. That's what he wants. A life of security, where he can just stop with all this journeying round and not settling down and not fitting in. But of course, the great lie of that way of thinking is that there is no security for those who settle for settling in this life. There is no security. When Abram, when he went to Egypt for security, he simply finds himself paranoid that Pharaoh's going to steal his wife and kill him. And as for Lot, well, Lot's choice of home is literally heading for destruction. Do you see the end of verse 10? This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, but destroy it he will, and soon. And did you see who Lot was living amongst in verse 13 of chapter 13? The men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. You see, settling in this life, in this world, it can seem attractive. And in some ways, so it should, because we do still live in a world that God made that's filled with blessings. But settling for settling down in this world is always settling for second best. Because the truth is, you can't ever truly settle down in a world in rebellion against God, because there is no peace or security in a world like that. Now, I know a few of you have come to London recently to build a better life for yourselves and your families. And I hope that you will find relatively more peace and security in London. I hope you do. But can I say that as long as London is a city full of people who refuse to worship God and to live for themselves, well, you can be assured that there will always be reasons to lie awake at night worrying. That is precisely what I've been doing for the last week. Last Saturday, I think it was, three cars were burgled on my road in broad daylight. I saw two of them being burgled. The guy with a hammer just comes along, smashes the window and takes stuff from them. I personally have had one car vandalized on that road. I had another car torched when I lived in North London. All that was left was a burnt out shell. Do you ever lie awake at night feeling insecure? God's promises are of a world where there is no more sin, where everybody worships him like Abraham does here, where people trust him, and they're not out for themselves anymore, but worshiping the God who loves bad people, they learn to love each other. So don't settle for settling in this world. It's second best. It might appear more attractive, but not if you understand what God is promising. And finally, very briefly, don't wander from God's promises, but keep wandering through the world as a worshipper. You know, if you have felt yourself wandering, it's never too late to do a U-turn. Lot's decision to live in Sodom, it was disastrous. We'll see that play out over the coming chapters. But in this section, we see a more positive picture, don't we? Abram heads the wrong way, but comes back. Literally comes back to the same faith he had at the first. In 13 verse 4, he goes back to the first altar that he made, as it were, kind of hitting the reset button on his faith, going back to the beginning. And from there, traveling on, building altars, worshipping God, calling on his name. I'm going to be glamping for just a few short days over the summer, just one weekend. But I intend, and I hope you intend too, to spend your whole lives wandering through this world, never settling, but always seeking to worship God wherever you go. I know that there are going to be wobbles for all of us along the way, but I also know that God is always ready to reaffirm his promises to anybody who reaffirms their faith in him. That's what he does at the end of the passage for Abraham. And my great prayer for this whole series, for all of us, is that it would help us, all of us, recommit our lives to a firm faith in our faithful God.